This meeting of the House Transportation Committee will now come to order. It is 1:05 p.m. on Tuesday, April 7th in Capitol Room 124. Members present are G. Nelson, Representative McCabe, Representative Mina, Representative St. Clair, Co-Chair Carrick, and myself, Co-Chair. Representative Eichheit, Representative G. Nelson, I don't know if I said rep before I said your name. Did I do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that's important to me. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before I begin, I would like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records, as well as Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee meeting today. Our committee aides are Meredith Traynor and Stafford Griffin-Scale. Thank you all for your excellent work on this committee. On today's agenda, we will first have a presentation from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities on rural aviation updates. We anticipate a hard stop on that presentation at 2:15 p.m., approximately an hour and 8 minutes from now. We will then hear invited and public testimony on House Bill 317, DOT Wildland Urban Interface Maintenance Plan, and set an amendment deadline for the bill. So, Mr. LaRue and Mr. Goins, welcome to the House Transportation Committee. Please approach the dais, introduce yourself, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation. And thank you for being here today.
Hi, my name is Christopher Goins. I'm the South Coast Region Director for the record, and thank you for having us today.
For the record, my name is Troy LaRue. I'm the Division's Operations Manager for Statewide Aviation under DOT and PF.
Please proceed.
All right. Thank you very much. And Catherine wasn't able to make it here since this was moved from March 12th originally, so we're just going to take it away. All right. So we're going to give you a little background on what the rural airport system is and what we do. We maintain about 250 plus state-owned rural airports, and we inspect about 400 airports. We do continuous snow and ice removal, plus de-icing and surface friction management, and we do a lot of the lighting electrical system maintenance to FAA standards. We manage aviation land leases for hangars, fuel facilities, and aviation businesses, and we coordinate those land uses with community governments so that we don't ultimately affect planes being able to come in and out of our airports. We procure and maintain specialized FAA-eligible snow removal equipment for our rural airports. We ensure airports comply with the FAA standards and grant assurances, and we coordinate with the Transportation Security Administration, which we all fondly call TSA. And we also administer airport improvement program grants, which often leads to a lot of the grant assurances that we have to carry for many decades moving forward. And we affectionately call that program the AIP, and you'll hear about that later on with the dollars associated that come in to support the development of our airports. Some of the challenges that we face, we do face aging infrastructure, especially given lighting. We have remote construction logistics, knowing Alaska and Lucian Chain and out in the interior, getting any sort of construction material to them is very challenging. And we also face harsh climate conditions that affect just the basics of things we do every year, like painting and being able to get that on in very wet environments oftentimes becomes a significant challenge. We also have workforce and operational demands that are ever-growing, it seems, and that covers engineering and M&O challenges, and Troy will talk a little bit about that.
Co-Chair Carrick.
Thank you, through Co-Chair. Thank you both so much for being here today. On the workforce challenges, I know the Fairbanks International Airport as well as the Anchorage International Airport had really major challenges relating to payroll processing. I'm wondering how much that impacts, if at all, our rural aviation staff and if that's a continuing problem.
Sure, I can answer. For the record, Troy LaRue, Statewide Aviation. We definitely have challenges across both systems. And I can tell you that Anchorage and Fairbanks have really worked together to try to meet the workman demand challenges. And I think they've done a very good job of it. They've done it through incentive pay and other incentives along with collective bargaining here recently. So they seem to be in fairly good posture right now. I think they're in a little better shape than we are in the rural aviation system.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you. Follow-up through the co-chair. So there was a payroll backlog that was impacting employees at those two major airports. It sounds like maybe that was also a challenge elsewhere. Is the incentive pay something that was happening concurrently, or is it meant to compensate for that backlog? And I guess more broadly, I know we're talking about rural aviation today, but do we still have a backlog in payroll processing for our airport employees?
Through the chair, co-chair Carrick, I believe that there are still some challenges out there, but what is happening is payroll's moving back underneath the Department of Transportation instead of under DOA, and we're very optimistic that we're going to have a little bit more local control over our folks and how their time is being submitted. There's also been improvements to the payroll timesheet and how things are being submitted today. So we're optimistic that this problem is going to be resolved.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
All right. For the record, Christopher Goins. Just give you some perspective of what is Alaska Aviation. Alaska covers 665,000 square miles of land, and our airspace is approximately 2.4 million square miles. To give you some perspective, if you were to lay our airspace on the lower 48 landmass, that's 78% of the lower 48 landmass is covered by our Alaska airspace. And give perspective. We have 10,000 active pilots in the state. We have approximately 4,000 airframes and power plant mechanics. We have 9,000 registered aircraft. Airports, we have 777 registered landing areas, 392 public use airports. This includes land base, seaplane bases, and heliports. We have 249 included in the National Plan of Integrated Airport Systems, and this is affectionately called NIPIUS, if you ever heard of that term. We have 26 of these airports hold certificates under Federal Aviation Regulations, Part 139. These are your type of airports that bring in jet passenger commercial service of the larger jets. Air Commerce, we have 5,275,750 enplanements each year. And we have approximately 4,000 unmanned aircraft systems there. About half of that is recreational, and the other part is more the commercial type. So, moving on, we talked about the airport improvement program. What we've said is AIP funding, and then what has happened the last several years was the bipartisan infrastructure law, or BIL, funding. And over the last 3 years, these two programs have brought in about $256 million on average each year. BIL, on average, has increased that funding by about 27% over 3 years. And what we've seen go to the rural system in 26 was $197 million on the AIP side and $26 million on the BIL side. That was about a 14% increase for having BIL around for about $225 million. The match requirement in 2026 is 5%. So to put that into perspective, on the highway side, it's about 9.03% is what you typically see. That is increasing in 2027 to 6.25 a match, except for our essential air service airports. Those are the ones that are subsidies through the essential air service program, and that's going to stay at 5% match.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Co-Chair Eichheit, so Mr. Goins, how many essential air service airports are there?
I'm going to pass that on to Troy. Otherwise, I'm going to guess.
For the record, Troy LaRue, Statewide Aviation Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I should know this number. I want to say it's 40-something. I want to say it's 48. But I'm sorry, I can't validate that right now.
Follow up. Okay, so pretty much the major villages, is that, I mean, most of the major villages have essential air service, is that right?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative McCabe, that is correct. And basically, the Essential Air Service Program was stood up in order to service communities that no longer have essential air service. So as soon as a community no longer gets scheduled service, they go to USDOT and say, hey, we need help. And that is what triggers EAS. So that number changes a little bit. Recently, Seward and and Chenega were the last two essential air service airports that were added to the system.
Thanks.
Co-Chair Carrick.
Thank you, through the co-chair. I guess I have the same question, but I'm not familiar with essential air service versus other distinctions. Is the EAS distinction apply for the major urban airports, and then it sounds like hub communities, or can what broadly speaking include what is included in an essential air service?
Through the chair, co-chair Carrick. So essential air service was stood up when deregulation happened. It used to be that there was a lot of regulation on where you could fly. Under President Reagan, that changed. And then when it did change, the promise to these communities that were in rural settings was, hey, if you had air service before deregulation and you lost air service any time after that, you are now eligible for essential air service.
And then as follow-up, through the chair, thank you, through the chair, why, can you add a little bit more to why we have a different match rate upcoming for essential air service airports versus the 6.25, which would apply to, it sounds like it's a bit sporadic across the state, whether something's essential air service or not classified that way. Do you have any other context about federally why there's that distinction there?
Through the chair, co-chair Carrick, I am not really sure when it comes to the Essential Air Service Program, and I know that there are a lot of questions taking place in D.C. right now for the need of essential air service. But I know that for Alaska, it's extremely important for us. The match, they dropped down to 5% match. And when I say they, I mean the FAA out of the trust fund said, okay, you know, we believe that aviation's taken a pretty big hit. So when the bipartisan infrastructure legislation hit, they said, you know what, let's reduce the match to 5% so that it's the same as all essential air service airports. Mm-hmm. And then when that program's over, we'll bring it back to the 6.25.
One more follow-up. Thank you, through the co-chair. Can communities who were not in that, thank you for the historical background too, but communities who were not originally classified as essential air service gain that distinction somehow?
Through the chair, co-chair Carrick. Yeah, that's a great question, actually. Chenega was the last one that I mentioned that was able to get essential air service. And during deregulation, because of our earthquake, they were no longer in that community. We had to go back and fight for them and say, hey, you know what? They had to move because of the earthquake, but they came back, so they should be eligible for essential air service. So that was a recent determination by the FAA.
Okay. Thank you.
Please proceed.
So next I want to talk about, and again, for the record, Christopher Goins, upcoming airport projects. And we have approximately 14 that are going to be coming to grant in the coming year. That means getting funding this year to move to construction and be bid. These include everything, and I'm not going to read every one, but just going to give you a sense of the type of work. We have airport relocation, culvert replacement, terminal expansions, lighting improvements, safety improvements, gate improvements such as on Alaska, drainage and lighting, snow removal equipment building, airport rehabilitation, and ultimately down on the very bottom, you have a seaplane ramp relocation and floats removal. One of the exciting things is because we've had additional money flow into the system, we have one project here that's going to be a whole year early, and that's the Haynes resurfacing, drainage, lighting, and snow removal equipment building. And we're going to be delivering that one this year for funding, and most of the construction is going to be in the coming year. one of the really exciting things, and it's the note very at the very top of the page, has to do what's new in the legislation this year, and that is an early start provision that is now possible. For our cold weather states, in the past, you had to wait for the grant before you could really get moving on a project, and that often would happen in late spring into summer. And so now we can ask for that funding earlier to get started earlier and not miss our window for construction. So that's been a legislative change that Troy and the department were back in DC advocating for, and that's a big win for us. So credit is where credit is due, my friend.
Question on that. So that just to clarify, that was advocacy happening in Washington, D.C. with our federal partners, correct? And can you just briefly describe that? That was an in-person meeting, and talk about what face-to-face interactions mean when it comes to bringing home the bacon, so to speak?
Sure. Through the chair, co-chair Eichheit. Oh, for the record, Troy LaRue, Statewide Aviation. I can tell you that there were a lot of different conversations that happened in D.C., and we always start with our congressional delegates, with Sullivan Murkowski, and the Senate has been just a really, really good friend to aviation. So when we look at FAA reauthorization, which I'll talk about a little bit later, there were probably, well, reauthorization, the first one that I participated in was 2018, and then we realized we didn't work hard enough. So we went straight to work after that in 2024. But I can tell you it was many trips to D.C. over several years.
Thank you. Representative Stutes.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit, through the chair.
I would hope. And just for the record, Representative Stutes
joined us at 1:20 p.m.
Thank you. I was just kind of hoping that when you said there was some additional funds in there, it was that 28.5 mil that we're not spending on Cascade Point right now.
Oh my gosh!
Was that a question, Representative Stutes?
No, that was an important comment, Mr. Co-Chair.
This is relevant.
Okay. Any further questions?
Okay. Please. Welcome back,
please.
Committee
members. Please. Please continue.
Christopher Goins, for the record, South Coast Region Director. It's good to have you back. All right. So next I want to talk about a couple airport terminal projects that we have going on. And these are funded through our BIL and our AIP program, but also some funding through the airport terminal program, what we call ATP funds. And these are two terminal projects in Sitka and in Ketchikan. And we're updating those terminals in partnership with a co-sponsorship agreement with those two communities. So those are awesome agreements that allow them to run the terminals there, and we support them and do a lot of the pass-through funding and making sure they're meeting the grant requirements. And these two co-sponsorship agreements were recently updated or brand new in the case of Sitka. And they take a lot of hard work and effort, both by the community and the department, to make them happen. But I can just say I am so grateful that they're there to be partnered with these communities and the hardworking people that we have to make this successful. And you can see the beautiful work that's already happened in Sitka with their terminal, and they're now into the final stretch of that. They're going to be completing that work at the terminal in 2026, the fall of. And then Ketchikan has currently started construction on their upgrades, and they'll be having additional funding come to them for phase two in this fiscal year. So exciting things are occurring.
Oh, I went the wrong way.
And now I'm going to turn it over to Troy LaRue.
For the record, Troy LaRue, Statewide Aviation, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. So as we look at our maintenance and operations and our capital improvement program together, it's important to realize that a lot of our maintenance activities and our equipment do come out of the capital improvement program. And the cost of equipment and maintenance projects are actually going up. So we're hoping to see more money in the airport improvement program in the future. But if you really look at what our needs are, we have to carve about $24.6 million out of the capital improvement program, out of the airport improvement program each year in order to support these activities. But what's really important about these activities is in the rural setting, if our equipment isn't up to speed and we have to send mechanics out to fix it, it's extremely difficult to get out there. So we need reliable, resilient equipment. And if we don't do these maintenance projects, these 27 runway maintenance projects, we won't have the resiliency on these runways, and we'll end up reconstructing them much sooner than it would take otherwise. So as we look at statewide aviation and how we spend our money and where we get our money from, you'll see within the aviation component, we do spend a little bit of general fund money. The international airport system actually is interdependent on the rural aviation system, and so they contribute as well. We have capital improvement program receipts, which I kind of covered on the last slide. We have leasing receipts, airport receipts, that we spend as well. And there's an other category down there, and that's because we sold a couple buildings this last year, so it added a little bit of revenue. As we look at our challenges, our airport workforce is extremely challenging to attract equipment operators, mechanics, and electricians. These are professional services that are really, really difficult for us to recruit today. If you're an equipment operator in an airport or you're an equipment operator at a road system, the road system doesn't have near the training requirements or regulatory requirements that an airport program has. So if you're a greater operator and you know you can pretty much make the same money on the road system as you can at the airport, then we have to really encourage people, hey, come to work for the airport. It's great. They have to be clean shaven if they're going to be firefighters, and there's an awful lot of training that goes along with being an airport operator. It takes us about a year to train up somebody at a certified airport in order to say, okay, we would trust you to be on the airfield alone, reporting conditions and maintaining the airport. We're working really hard with our unions today to recruit, along with other recruiting efforts. And one of the things that we found is where we were working people week on, week off, sometimes two on, two off was better than week on, week off. So started working with the unions on how can we get some flexibility with our folks. And where we just flat out can't recruit, we're contracting out.
Mr. LaRue, so one of the things you said was, if I understood you right, is a runway clearing grader is the same pay as a road grader in terms of the pay for the job. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Deichheit, it's very close. There is a little bump if you're working at a certified airport and you're a firefighter. But, yeah, it's one range. It's not a lot of difference.
Okay. It seems like there's higher standards, and it seems like the drivers, the operators would be paid more, but not significantly. Is that something that, you know, we're not supposed to talk about union negotiations, but is that a conversation you have with your operator unions?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Eichheit, yes, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of times when we're in collective bargaining sessions, a lot of these things are brought to light. Sometimes it's hard to tip the scale very hard depending on where our budget is and that sort of thing. So I'm optimistic that we're going in the right direction. I think that this challenge could be compounded by a gas pipeline and other infrastructure needs that the state is working on today.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Slide 9, previous one. Just as a comment, it looks like you might have to replace that road grader. It looks like it's about to kiss a plane, just as a comment. But then on slide 7, sorry, these things are just kind of percolating, so I know I'm lagging a little bit. So just to clarify, through the co-chair, it said annual need is $25 million required to prevent backlog. And you were talking, was that specifically for equipment?
And that'd be slide 7.
Yes. Slide 7, yep. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, that includes equipment and the maintenance grants that we're producing.
Okay, follow up. And so looking at this slide, you know, I don't know if you're connected to LaRue, the LaRue blowers. I don't know if you're connected. But, like, you know, you got, depending on what you got there, you got almost $1.5 million worth of equipment there. And how do you prioritize what equipment, or do you have some kind of a matrix on what equipment goes to what airports, higher priorities versus lower? You know, if you're, you know, sending out that, that's a lot of money and equipment right there. And just how do you manage that in these airports?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, we get together with a committee with M&O and State Equipment Fleet, and then we go through all of the needs, and then we try to make sure that they're fit into a fiscal year. Oh, and no, LaRue is not related to me. They're out of, actually out of Canada, so they don't meet Buy America.
Yeah, I've worked around that before.
Yeah, follow up.
Okay, so you can't buy LaRue snowblowers? I thought there was a workaround on them being assembled in the U.S. I know we're getting right down into the weeds of this, but, I mean, that's a good blower. I mean, and Craig Taylor sells them, I think, to you guys.
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, I know that we have one out at either Dead Horse or Barrow last time I was there. And I asked them, I said, how did you procure this? And they said it was during a period of time of exemption. So if Craig Taylor's, if they do meet Buy America, I'm not aware of that yet. But I'll look into it.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
All right, so the Don Young Alaska Aviation Safety Initiative was something that happened through reauthorization that really put Alaska in the spotlight. In Alaska, you know, we almost have 2.5 times higher the accident rates that the U.S. has in the lower 48, which is a really, really huge number when you consider our small population, considering the population in the lower 48 and the amount of air traffic in the lower 48 versus the air traffic in Alaska. So the goal within this initiative is to reduce the amount of fatal accidents by 90% by 2033. And so as we started working on how are we going to accomplish this, weather was one of the biggest objectives. Due to the lack of weather or due to the lack of existing weather systems that are down, it has really, really hampered our ability to travel within Alaska. So that is one of the big highlights, and FAA is working on that, partnered with us as we speak. One of the other areas is ADS-B, which is a surveillance program that allows airplanes to see each other. And while this is a really good program, we don't have the infrastructure or the ground controls that are needed in order to really maximize its potential. So that's happening. The other thing that we really struggled with, if you look at our firefighting capabilities up north and the reason that we need long runways, they didn't fit within the airport improvement program. Neither do fish hauls or fuel hauls, because they don't meet the 500 operations that are demanded to determine your critical design type aircraft. Today, through reauthorization, if we say, no, we need economic development, or we need fish hauls, or we need firefighting, or we need to deliver fuel in the winter, we can keep our existing infrastructure, or we could build infrastructure to meet that demand. Whereas over the last few years, FAA was encouraging us to shorten runways or to reduce the width based on a critical design type aircraft. We don't have to follow that anymore, which is really great. Our snow equipment removal buildings have been historically too small, but guidance wouldn't let us build them bigger under the federal program. We would have had to use state dollars to do that. We can do that now, too. Runway markings and crack sealing is really important. FAA would only fund that every 3 years. Well, that put a big burden on the state. We can fund those every year now.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Quick question on, you know, you were talking about that Alaska contains 0.2%, but account for 5.4% of the fatal aviation crashes. And on an earlier slide, you talked about the number of registered aircraft and the active pilots. How does that roughly compare to a national average? Because, I mean, we hear that we have the most pilots, you know, per capita. And just what is that actually? What's the difference there, or the delta?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Nelson, it's a good question. Per capita, we definitely have more pilots in airplane than anybody else in the lower 48. We also have the biggest aviation system that I know of in the world. So aircraft are very, very important here for sure.
Representative McCabe, I think.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Eichheit. So that's explained. They parse the accident rate per flight hour. So even though we have more pilots and we have more flying, you know, we have six times the number of pilots of other states on average, right? So you would think, yeah, if you parse it out per capita, it's about, you know, it's actually less, but they parse it out by per flight hour, which is why we have 2.4 or 2.5% higher than anywhere else. So it's significant, or times, rather. So.
60% of all mid-air collisions that happen in the United States take place in Alaska. That's a big number.
Go ahead.
So as we look at our challenges, a lot of our lighting systems are aging, and Commissioner Anderson challenged us when he became appointed to look at our lighting systems, and we figured out that a lot of these systems were really, really old. 28 of them currently have problems that are very, very hard to fix. So he encouraged us, let's get some lighting projects stood up and let's get these fixed. And lights aren't just runway lights. They're taxiway lights. They're rotating beacons. You can't have a night op without lights and a rotating beacon. So they're really, really important, especially in our hours of darkness here. We have 8 airport replacement lighting projects underway right now, and we are trying to train current staff. It is really, really hard to attract electricians, so we have had to contract out quite a bit, but we do have contractors available to meet this demand immediately when we have problems. Being able to train the public too. We had a lot of vandalism problems over the years, and I think that we've curbed that lately. And that's by community outreach and saying, hey, man, we really need these lights to work, or, you know, Grandpa might not be able to get medevaced out at night. Where we are still struggling with these problems, with these lighting problems, we have emergency lighting kits that we've deployed. They're fairly affordable right now, and the medevacs are able to put those into their op specs so that when we are struggling with lighting systems, we still have the ability to get in and out at night.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So maybe you could separate out how much the damage this year cost versus last year. You said it was getting better, and I think I ask this question every year. Andy could probably tell you, but the vandalism is one of the things that really upsets me, because it's kids on four-wheelers driving up and down the runway where they shouldn't be anyways, with big pieces of wood teeing off with the lights. And so
through the chair, Representative McCabe, I don't know of any vandalism issues that have happened within the last 4 months or 5 months. So since it started getting dark, we've done really well. I believe that there were 3 different systems that were damaged last year, and the damage wasn't like they went around the airfield with a four-wheeler and a baseball bat. It was just torn up at one end. But yeah, that it has been reduced, and we will take the IOU to make sure we give you an accounting.
Thanks.
Just help me understand that, the vandalism. So, you know, a lot of folks have done vandal acts in the past, but that seems like such a fundamental danger, especially if airstrip is your only way in and out. So this has been a pretty severe problem in the past, and it sounds like talking to the community about the importance of this infrastructure has made a difference. But so it happens, it sounds like, pretty frequently.
And through the chair, Representative Eichheit, I believe it's being reduced. You know, we had a school principal in one community that anytime there was vandalism at the airport in the community, he took a light bulb out of the gym in the school. And eventually it stopped. And so when we can partner with communities and say, hey, this infrastructure is really important to you, not just the airfield, but other infrastructure within the community, we're noticing that the climate's changing.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So you can see in that picture about how high those lights are. and they're just about waist level if you're sitting on a four-wheeler. and it was a sport for a while in some of the villages I flew into with a couple kids on a four-wheeler, and it is very costly to our budget and to, you know, getting in and out sometimes at night. So.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you. Go ahead.
Bears, cows, and other animals also vandalize our airfields. So, as I had mentioned earlier, weather reporting is extremely important, and one of the things that FAA Reauthorization 24 focused on, what we're focusing on isn't just putting in new weather instruments, but it's making sure that the instruments that are deployed today are working correctly. And so FAA didn't really have a good hot map or dashboard to show us what was up or what was down. So over the last few years, we developed a dashboard. This is the dashboard as of 3/10/26, and we're noticing that there's usually around 14 to 22 systems that are down that are deployed today. On our Alaska Aviation System Plan website, you can pull up this particular map, and it'll show you what's up and what's down, but it will also show you where future automated weather observation systems and visual weather observation systems will be placed over the next 2 years. You can tell that a lot of these weather systems definitely have some issues and some problems. And when weather is not being reported, it definitely prevents 121 operations at that airport. So you're not going to get your food and your groceries until that weather system is fixed again.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, whose responsibility is it to fix those weather stations? And I'm specifically referring to Yakutat. They've had some significant long-term issues. I don't know. Unfortunately, it's not my district anymore, so I don't know if it's been repaired. But it's been horrendous down there for them. And I'm wondering, A, has it been fixed, and B, whose responsibility is it to fix it?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, great question. And, I can tell you that Senator Murkowski didn't make it in there 1 year. And so next thing you know, there's probably about 30 of us standing on that ASOS a few weeks later trying to explain to her when it was going to be up and fixed and how it was going to be resilient after that.
It was, she couldn't make it out, and I was there with her, and I didn't make it out either. And it was clear as a bell, it looked like, but one of the weather stations wasn't working, and so the plane couldn't land.
Yeah, this particular system is an ASOS, so it's owned by the Weather Service and maintained by the FAA, and it's scheduled for replacement. But it was located in such a way on the airport that it was really hard to make that system resilient. So the idea was, when we left, was the National Weather Service was going to put a backup system in there called a MOS system. And I understand that it has been deployed and they're testing that system in Yakutat. Meanwhile, they are going to replace the ASOS as well. One of the fundamental problems in Yakutat that we still need to partner and figure out is that the power is pretty thready going out to the airport. It's a direct burial cable, and it has brownouts out there. And when all of a sudden the power gets thready, it starts to knock out some of those electrical instruments. So we're trying to figure out how to make sure that a good battery backup and a power conditioning system is deployed as well.
Follow up. Thank you. So is DOT working in collaboration with the feds and the community then?
Absolutely.
Perfect. Thank you.
And then I have a question. We're talking about who's responsible. Is the technology old? Do we need upgraded infrastructure for this technology? Is it a combination of our tough weather? What explains all the outages, please?
Co-Chair Eichheit, it could be anything from bad power to bad comms. Bad comms are being fixed as we speak, between Starlink and other communication devices that are available today, this technology is changing our lives. And so we're seeing the resilience that way. I believe the FAA spends about $600 million a month on comms in Alaska alone, and a lot of them weren't working. So we're seeing that change rapidly today.
Thank you.
So if you look at this slide, FAA is going to install 44 AWASs and 50 VWASs over the next 2 years. And VWAS is probably a new weather instrument that you haven't heard of before. It's called a visual weather observation system. And it is much more affordable and easier to deploy than an AWAS. An AWAS costs over $2 million to build and deploy, and a VWAS is about $150,000 to build and deploy.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, through the chair. Can you give me just a little bit of information about what a nutshell, AWAS and VWAS is? It's got to be, it's some kind of equipment, I know that, but.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stutes. So an automated weather system, or in the case of the Weather Service, it's an ASOS. They're both maintained by the FAA for the most part, but they are a premier weather system. They have just a tremendous amount of technology that are embedded into these systems. The visual weather system, believe it or not, is using visual technology now to then disseminate the weather to pilots. And it's been a pilot program of the FAA's for many years now. It is just now coming to the stage to be approved for aviation weather so that you can make a no-go decision as a pilot.
One follow-up. Thank you. So as you're a pilot and you're coming in, can the pilot directly contact this system? Is that how it works?
And yep. Then these systems will broadcast the same way that an AWAS or an ASOS system would broadcast.
And then it has to be a certain criteria.
Correct.
Gotcha. I saw the nod.
So, Representative McCabe, can you clarify this? I was going to ask you a question.
So AWAS is Automated Weather Observation System, and ASOS is Automated Surface Observation System. Some of them you can call on the phone, and some of them will report before you leave. And so if you're an IFR scheduled, you have certain requirements at that airport. This is Yakutat. You have to have an AWAS that reports that criteria or you can't go, which maybe it's a tailwind or maybe it's a visibility. If you don't have that visibility, you can't go. In other words, you can't take off. Even so, if you don't have the reporting system like you did in Yakutat, doesn't matter if it's clear and blue skies, you still can't go if you're a scheduled, or some sort of a high 121 charter thing. There was an AWAS they put up in Anaktuvik, and they put it up right downwind of some guy's heater. Fired off his heater, it produced a little cloud that covered the AWAS system, and it was always reporting instrument flight conditions when it was beautiful, but it was because of the smoke from this guy's thing. Yes. Anyways, it's this old system, but it's getting better with that VWAS stuff, a lot better.
One last follow-up. Oh, yeah. Thank you. I haven't quite figured out what my strong suit is, but I know what they aren't, and this is one of them. So it's an automated thing where you don't talk to anybody. It's a machine that gathers the weather. Interesting. Thank you.
So it'll through the chair, yes, if you don't mind. So it will continually report. So it has a frequency. It, as a pilot's 50 or 60 miles out, however far that it will transmit, he'll dial up the AWAS on his frequency, and it'll report the winds and the weather and that kind of thing. And then many of them also have a way to get a hold of them via the phone before you leave or before you're dispatched. So,
Cool.
May I follow up?
Yeah.
Through the chair, there are three ways that they should be disseminating weather. One is on the internet. You should be able to pull it up on the internet and get it. The other one is through the aircraft radio, and the other one is calling.
Yeah, I forgot about the internet.
Oh, I have then one last.
Yeah. One final follow-up. Then we'll go to co-chair.
So if I go to AWOS on the internet, it'll pull it up?
through the chair, you need to go to the FAA website and then ask for weather. But there are many, many different ways. I think if you Googled FAA weather, I think it would pull it up too.
Ah, thank you very much.
Representative McCabe?
Yeah, so you can look up the airport, and oftentimes it will have a link. So if you wanted to know what it's doing in Akiak or Karluk, if it has an AWAS, I'm not sure that they have one, or an ASOS, you would just pull up, you know, the identifier for Karluk, or pull up Karluk Airport, and there's usually a little link there, and it says AWAS, and you click on the link, and it will take you there.
How cool is that? Thank you.
Yeah. Co-Chair Carrick.
Thank you, through the co-chair. I'm sorry if I missed this when we first started on this slide, but the FAA is working on installing more systems, and I assume updated systems as needed. Is that, does that 44 AWAS and 50 VWAS stations satisfy the need for both of those, or is there, are there going to be communities that won't receive updates or upgrades?
Through the chair, co-chair Carrick. That's a great question. So there in FAA reauthorization, it calls out covered airports. And so we are meeting that demand on covered airports. There's over 700 places to land in Alaska. So trying to determine where to prioritize is extremely difficult. And in the slide that I'm on right now, I'll talk about that a little bit. But as we look at the demand and the need, we believe that we're going to come really close to meeting this need with the covered airport list.
Great.
So as we look at FAA reauthorization, we had asked them through the Don Young Alaska Aviation Safety Initiative, we'd asked the FAA for help with a lot of our approaches. We have many approaches here in Alaska that we discovered were not available to land at night. And with our hours of darkness, it makes it really, really difficult. So the good news is, I'll jump to the bottom of the slide, on 3-1-26, we had some flight checks from the FAA that were definitely executed here in Alaska. We've never tried to do flight checks in the middle of winter before. We were a little bit nervous about it, but we thought that the need to get people in and out of these communities at night was really, really important. So we were able to lift these restrictions at Togiak, Crooked Creek, Koliganek, Manly Hot Springs, and Hooper Bay. We still have a lot of airports that have these issues. So as we're moving forward, we just received funding from the FAA, $1.5 million, to do site assessments to remove the obstructions and to fix these not available at night issues. We are going to be then looking forward after this initiative to not only correct these problems, but to look at our system holistically for all of our approaches, because we believe that there are there's ways to mitigate this problem from happening in the future. But a lot of times, in order to lift this restriction, it requires a flight check from the FAA, and there are two aircraft right now that the FAA uses for flight checks for the whole entire nation, and it's extremely difficult then to schedule them to come up and to flight check Alaska.
And just, I see on your priority one there, you had Willow listed. I would think Willow would have an active air community, and does that mean there's not night aids there? Is that what that means? Representative McCabe, I mean,
I don't think Willow has lighting, do they?
They do.
Do they have lighting?
Yeah. But they don't have weather.
Oh, they don't have weather, yeah.
Okay. Surprising. Very surprising.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Aishai, the other thing that by deploying this systems that it helps Alaska do is weather forecasting. We don't have a lot of weather modeling that happens here in Alaska because we can't tie all of these instruments together, and we don't have enough of them throughout the state in order to help the forecasting.
Mm-hmm.
So as we look at FAA reauthorization, one of the important aspects is the Airport Improvement Handbook updates. When the Airport Improvement Handbook came out, it restricted us to fund a lot of the infrastructure challenges that we're faced with today, and we're going to be able to do that now. We were able to put together a program guidance letter for the state of Alaska that actually helped us fund a lot of components here over this last year and will help us in the future. I mentioned runway length and snow equipment, removal buildings. We're seeing a lot of relief through our program guidance letters, but these program guidance letters are supposed to be folded into the new AIP handbook rewrite that's underway. And in this rewrite, it really calls out all of the airports that are outside the continental United States. We've had a lot of ability to show our need since we're not on the contiguous road system, but Hawaii and the territories also fall into that same bucket. So we've been able to not only show success for Alaska eligibility, but it also is helping out Hawaii and the territories. If we can't get all of our issues that are within program guidance letters addressed in an AIP handbook, there is talk about having an appendix just for the airports that are off the contiguous road system. Or maybe even a standalone AIP handbook for those airports. So another one of our big challenges today is TSA. TSA has continued to increase regulatory requirements, and it doesn't come with a lot of funding. So while FAA comes with funding, it's really, really hard sometimes to meet these TSA requirements. Today we have 18 airports that are required airport access badges. You have to have a badge for every different airport. We don't have a badge that works for all of them. So let's say you work at Anchorage and Fairbanks and Yakutat and Dillingham. You're going to have 4 badges for each airport. It's going to take 2 visits to the airport to complete the badge requirement. So if you actually live in Anchorage, but you're working part-time in Dillingham sometimes for Alaska Airlines, it means that you have to fly out there, go through the process. The next time you come out, you can complete your badging process. So it's extremely difficult for airport users. It's something that we're hoping to change in the future. We're talking to TSA about a 1 badge that would work at multiple airports. It's an extremely hard nut to crack. No other state has done it yet, and we've been working for a couple years now with TSA on this concept. We believe that we can get there, but it's going to take some technology and some infrastructure advancements in order to make that happen. Another hard area that we have that TSA came and said you're out of compliance is airport hangars that were within a fence line become airport access. And so we needed to have blueprints of every hangar on every one of our airports that were access points for the airport, and then we had to demonstrate to the TSA how that hangar was secured and that people can't erroneously access the airport. It was a huge undertaking. We had to work with our tenants and use a Matterport to go in and then video and come up with blueprints. Every time there's a regulatory increase, there's a burden that's put on our staff, and it's extremely difficult. And then other burdens like Real ID, we were getting calls from TSA saying, hey, we're not getting local support to help us adjudicate people that don't have Real ID. And really what they were looking for is just to make sure there weren't any real wants or warrants for some of these folks. And it took some collaboration. Well, if you're out chasing bad guys in rural Alaska and somebody calls you up and says, will you help me with an ID check? You got to kind of weigh where your priorities are. So it's extremely difficult. We don't have a lot of federal support to help with these activities, so it's been a challenge for us.
I have a question on that. I don't quite understand what's happening here, because you know TSA has a mission, but it seems like if you have 1 airport badge, it should be good. Yes, like my Alaska State driver's license is good throughout, well, the nation actually, but it's I don't have to get a different license when I go to another community. So can you explain what's happening with TSA? I mean, are they overzealous? I know you don't want to say anything bad about them, and I'm not asking you to, but what explains this?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Aisha, you know, it's kind of interesting when you start to crack a security net, where do you start and stop with it? And Alaska is so much different than the lower 48. In our communities, everybody knows everybody. If you're an ADAC and you're going to get on an airplane, do you think those other people in the terminal don't know exactly who you are or who you aren't, maybe in that case? So we believe that there may be a little bit of overreach on TSA in Alaska. Two airplane flights to ADAC per week drives us to stand up a security program, and it's really difficult. And as we're trying to recruit law enforcement officers and other folks to meet these regulatory requirements, it's extremely difficult. Some communities we can't partner with because the airport is outside of the airport boundary, or it is too far for a law enforcement officer to make a response to that airport. So it's been extremely difficult. And I know that Director Goines is going to talk in great length about that here in a minute.
Well, just as a follow-up, so is part of the problem that you have folks in TSA making these decisions who essentially don't live in Alaska? They live somewhere in the lower 48, and they have no idea what life is like here? Is that partial explanation?
Through the chair, Representative Eichheit, yes, absolutely. Now, I can tell you that the folks in leadership here in Alaska from TSA, they know. And we have a great relationship with them, but they have to convince other people who have put a cookie-cutter regulation out that Alaska could maybe deviate from that.
Yeah. Christopher Goines, for the record. South Coast region. So let's talk about one of the challenges that comes from those TSA requirements. We had two issues that came up on two Part 139 airports, and these are airports that take commercial passenger service into them. So think an Alaska Airlines flight landing into your community. And this popped up in Kodiak and Gustavus. And there are requirements that each of those Part 139 airports has specifically related to law enforcement officers or and what kind of came up in both those communities is the response time, for instance, in Kodiak couldn't meet the 15-minute requirement. So when a call is made out because of an issue at TSA, the law enforcement officer has to be on site within 15 minutes. And that wasn't able to be met by the state troopers there in Kodiak. And I'll get into a little bit later why the same sort of challenges popped up in Gustavus. Some of the things that they have to have those law enforcement officers have to have is arrest authority, so authority to make arrest with or without a warrant for crimes committed in their presence. They have to be clearly identified. They have to be armed with a firearm and officially authorized to use it, and then they must complete a training program that meets the regulatory standards.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, through the chair. Is that a TSA program they have to complete when it says they have to successfully complete a training program, or is it affiliated with being a trooper?
Through the co-chair to Representative Stutes, it is a requirement that they meet the standard at TSA with the whatever program they use. So,
thank you.
Yeah. So in Kodiak, again, the state troopers weren't able to meet that requirement, and that had a lot to do with resourcing challenges that are going on in the police force, and also the expansive area that you heard Troy talk about earlier. If they're out somewhere else on the island trying to deal with another issue and a call comes up, they have to go check a real ID or something like that, that becomes a problem, and they just couldn't make it anymore. So we ended up having to look at what are the other local avenues that we could maybe use, and unfortunately we couldn't get to any of those, but we did try the Coast Guard. The problem there was they didn't have the correct arrest authority requirements. We talked to the local police department. It was outside their jurisdictional boundary, and they had staffing challenges, much like state troopers did. And then we looked at contracted police force, but we couldn't get them with the secure arrest authority that was required. So ultimately, we came up with an option because we needed to make sure that flight service could get into and out of Kodiak. And this option was to utilize qualified officers from the Fairbanks International Airport team, rotating them out on a 3-day cycle, all on overtime pay, mind you, so very expensive, paying for all their expenses to be there during that time. But that got us to the point where we could continue that air service into Kodiak. What was at risk was losing that Part 139 certificate if we didn't do that, and also civil violations of $17,000 per violation. So that is not per day, that is per incident. If you imagine there's two flights a day, you multiply that 365, that's over $12 million worth of potential fines. So we had to find a solution. And we'll go through the numbers on what that solution is ultimately costing our H&A budget there in South Coast region.
And just for committee's awareness, we got about 10 minutes before we want to finish. Representative McCabe?
Thanks. Yeah, so the problem's not Kodiak. It's not the Kodiak to Anchorage flight. It's the fact that once you land in Anchorage, you don't have to get rescreened. You're already inside the sensitive area. So the TSA is regulating Kodiak because the airplane lands in Anchorage or Seattle or wherever it lands, and that is the larger thing. So some of the 9/11 group actually got into the system in airports like Kodiak, like smaller airports that had less security. So they're regulating the whole system, and they're doing it at the beginning of the first jet flight.
Thank you. Co-chair Carey?
Thank you. Through the co-chair, I guess what Representative McCabe just said, that was what I was thinking. But I'm wondering, when did this kind of ramp up of smaller regional airport hubs with TSA begin? Because it seems relatively recent. Like, this didn't happen right after 9/11. I have personal experience flying into and out of Nulato. You have to go through Galena, and Galena didn't have TSA. Do they now? I mean, when did this kind of ramp up of TSA on this front begin?
For the record, Troy LaRue, Statewide Aviation Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. It really did happen after 9/11, but it's just been increasing ever since. And I think that a lot of the regulatory requirements that we're faced with today were actually put into place after 9/11, but weren't necessarily enforced to the degree that they're enforced today. There are new security directives that come out quite often that definitely require us to take action, and it can be really, really tough to meet these requirements.
Just a quick
follow-up.
Yeah, through the co-chair. I guess what efforts have other states or has our DOT undertaken to get some kind of federal funding compensation for these increased costs? Because we have a lot of smaller regional hub airports. And I could just see a never-ending cycle. I mean, technically, you can get to a lot of our Southeast and Aleutian communities on a boat. It's very small communities, which means you could then fly into an airport like Sitka or whatever. And I mean, it just, where does it end, I guess, is the question. And do we have any mechanism to recover these costs? Is our congressional delegation doing any advocacy around this?
Through the chair, co-chair Carrick, we're on the same page. I can tell you that it is extremely difficult to challenge TSA regulatory requirements. And generally, when I've pushed back pretty hard, it's not been a good thing. So trying to partner with other states is extremely difficult as well. We have other partnerships through national organizations that we're trying to work with relief on. But in the lower 48, they don't have the resource challenges that we do here in Alaska, and it's really hard to kind of motivate them to fight for an Alaska initiative if it's not an initiative of their own.
Yeah, I guess that was more of a comment than anything. Just, I don't know how we as a state can compensate for the increased cost here, and I don't think any other state has as many rural regional hubs as Alaska, so it seems like a never-ending problem.
So if you go into Sitka from Gustavus on an air taxi, you have to get through security on Sitka before you get on the jet that takes you to Anchorage. If you go in, if you're coming out of Bethel on the jet, you'll have to go through security. But if you just go through an air taxi and go somewhere on an air, you don't typically have to go through air taxi. It's only if your final destination hits one of those 139 airports, the major, whether it be Anchorage or Seattle or Fairbanks or any of those, where you would be inside the secure area and access a big jet that goes somewhere in the lower 48 or...
Permission to dialogue, Coach.
We do have 5 more minutes.
I know. This is such an interesting topic, though. But, I guess I'm going to use Galena as an example again, because Galena doesn't have this TSA security. So you could theoretically get on a small plane in one of the outlying communities, go to Fairbanks from Galena, but you're not entering into the secure area because it's a different airline service. So that level of specificity, I'm getting a head nod, but that level of specificity is what TSA is looking for when determining which hub airports to include. Okay. Interesting. Thank you.
Christopher Goins for the record, South Coast Region Director. That's exactly it. There's 26 of these Part 139 airports. It's all about being on the secured area or not on the secured area, and they will deposit you depending on what you've entered into the next airport, either into that secured area or non-secured area for these exact reasons and associated with 9/11. And Gus Davis, and one of the things that I think is really important, we had a partnership that was working for a very long time with the National Park Service as the LEO. They came to us and said, hey, we're not able under, we looked at our legal requirements that we're acting under, and what TSA is asking us to do doesn't fit under our emergency authorization. Therefore, we cannot do this, and it would be a personal liability to our officers in the field to be able to do this at your airport. And so that left us in the same situation we were in Kodiak of, okay, now we have to find an LEO to do this. When you look at the local options, there's no village public safety officer, no desire from the local community, no local police force, no desire from the local community to do that, no local state trooper. So the solution we came up with there is pretty unique, and I'm quite proud of my team. We found qualified retired officers here in Juneau. We fly them out every day for 90 days, which is what that EAS service, the Essential Air Service, does for us. They fly out, they get out, they do their job, they get back on the plane, they fly back with all the passengers back to Juneau, enter the secure area, and go home. But they allow for that 90-day service to occur there. If we didn't have that, we would lose the subsidy, that $191,000 a year. It would be a loss of Alaska Airlines flights into Gus Davis. We would have the civil penalties, and we would have a significant harm to government and business economies. The budget breakdown for this, I'll just say it really quickly. Kodiak, as you know, paying OT and flying everybody in, this is about $900,000 a year. For Gus Davis, about $70,000 a year to cover that 90 days and making sure that we can meet those requirements with the TSA. So right now we are carrying that cost on our overhead budget and have had to make significant cuts within the region to make this all work. Representative Stutes, we are proud to say we still have air service for you in the Kodiak.
Are you happy? How do you think I got here?
I got to try to make you happy somehow.
Very. You got here on the ferry.
So last I want to talk about just some of the drone-enabled assessments that happened with Typhoon Heilong. This was exciting to be a part of and watch the system grow to see what they can then do now. And a lot of this is, Travis Watkins is in the picture. He's one of our folks here at South Coast who's been implementing this technology on construction. And it just implemented right into response on the engineering side. And we had 40 DOT and PF staff completed assessments in 34 communities in 3 days following or right after this. And our drone teams delivered that rapid, agile response during these crises that allowed us to deploy remote drones and real-time data coming back to the engineers, where we sat in the room with 16 different engineers, and we were looking at post imagery next to old satellite data and sliding bars to determine, hey, this is the damage here. These are the resources we need to get into these communities. This is the stuff we need to get back to the emergency management system so that they understand what the resources need to be coming into these communities. And this program has completely grown to all the data and the facts that you have here so that we can live stream this from remote communities using Starlink. So I would be watching into these communities, looking at the real the places where they were flying right on the live screen with the deputy commissioner, making real-time decisions on the infrastructure that we need to be repairing and how to prioritize this. So just so proud of the team for that. What this meant in logistics was just a massive effort of employees, 250 employees, 15 contractors, 8 prime contractors, 55 different suppliers. This says 8 million pounds delivered. That's actually 13 million pounds today. We've delayed this by about a month, so these numbers have been updated. That also means we've installed 4,500 helical piles, 6,500 boardwalks installed all during the winter. We've moved 70 plus homes back into place, and 200 homes are now substantially repaired, with another 150 that we're working on. And this isn't possible without these coordinated efforts, without the ability able to get this data quickly and efficiently, working with our statewide emergency operations. And I just got to give a huge thank you to all those other state agencies, nonprofit and private partners, the governor's office, and the federal agencies that got us to this point. This is a massive success when it comes to restoring people to their homes and their livelihoods again. And so I just want to say thank you to our teams for the hard work. And this comes from, you know, right here, getting the technology right and working with our partners in statewide aviation. So a huge thank you to them.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
We made it.
We made it. Are there any final questions for our presenters? Representative Stutes.
Can you imagine that? I just want to say kudos to you guys, too, on that halong and your instant response. Incredible. It's really incredible. Sometimes I'm not so complimentary, but this should undo all those bad girls, because you guys did a stupendous job. Excellent. And, you know, we have members that are from that area, and I know that they're so incredibly grateful. So thank you.
Any other questions or comments? I would just ask one final question and a brief answer. You know, thank you for the presentation, but the question is, what is the state of our airports, you know, that you covered? You know, we saw some issues. We saw a lot of great work. The work continues to happen. Is there a grade you can give our airports? Which isn't a grade for any one specific thing or person, but just their overall condition. Where are we at overall at this point in 2026?
For the record, Troy LaRue, Statewide Aviation Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I give us a solid B. I'm extremely proud of where our system is today. Do we have challenges? Do we have room to grow? Do we have? Yeah, absolutely. We're always going to try to raise the bar, meet all of our challenges, and I love aviation. And most of the people working in aviation for the Department of Transportation love aviation, too.
Well, thank you, Mr. LaRue, for that robust grade, and thank you yourself and Mr. Goins for an excellent presentation, and we hope to see you again. So thank you so much. Okay, seeing no further questions, we're going to now move to take up House Bill 317. I do not see Representative Holland here to give some summary remarks on the bill, but would his staffer, Aiden Nickel, would you like to give any reminders of what House Bill 317 does before we go to invited testimony?
Yes, happily, co-chair. I should, for the record, Aiden Nickel, staff to Representative Holland. The representative had to step out for an unexpected urgent conflict, and will be back hopefully in just a minute. But in his stead happy to provide a brief summary. So House Bill 317 adds to the duties of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities to adopt a prioritization framework for routes that access communities that are only accessible via a single route. And the goal is that this department will evaluate these residential communities that are in areas threatened by wildfires and adopt systems for maintenance of these routes and the rights of way surrounding them in order to increase the safety of these communities. And if I may, Co-Chair Eichheid, we had an invited testifier who was unfortunately unable to make it. We do have a copy of her slides that were provided to the committee.
So I think we're going to, first of all, move into the person who is present. I understand we have invited testimony from a Dr. Paul Flint. So, Mr. Flint, please unmute yourself, introduce yourself, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony on House Bill 317.
Hello, Chair Eichheit. My name is Dr. Paul Flint. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm going to focus on this House Bill 317 and its effects on the neighborhood where I live, which is Bear Valley in the hills up above Anchorage. Bear Valley lies at the south end of Hillside Drive. It's essentially where Hillside becomes Rabbit Creek, if you're at all familiar with this area. Bear Valley Elementary School stands at the entrance to the valley. In the upper end of the valley is Chugach State Park. I lived in this area for over a decade. I currently serve on the Bear Valley Limited Road Service Area alongside Bill Ennis, who served as the chair of the LRSA for over 30 years. This House Bill 317 is relevant to my area because the greater Bear Valley area only has a single road into and out of it, and that is Clark's Road. Clark's Road is a state-maintained, two-lane paved road. It's cut in across the hillside, has minimal shoulders and ditching, but it's really a good road. It's well-maintained. It's in good condition. By my count, going on to the Municipality of Anchorage's tax records map, there are approximately 485 privately owned parcels in Bear Valley that use Clark's as their only way in and out. While not all of these parcels currently have residences on them, the number of parcels here that have houses built on them has been greatly increasing during my time period here, as well as the size of the houses that are here. There are also large parcels of land in the upper part of our valley, 10 to 40 acre parcels that have recently sold, and it's apparent that it's likely these will be subdivided and developed in the future. So the population of people living up here in Bear Valley that use this single access point is increasing, and that trend is likely to continue. Everyone that lives up here understands that Bear Valley it has only a single access point and the implications of that. This recently came to light when we had a vehicle accident in icy conditions along Clark's Road and ended up blocking both lanes of traffic. There was easily over 50 cars quickly piled up. This accident occurred 5 p.m. on a Friday after work commute was going on. The first fire truck was quickly on scene. We have the Bear Valley Fire Station very nearby, followed by an ambulance, another fire truck, then APD showed up. After a short time, it was clear that the ambulance was not necessary, and they had the desire to go on for other work. But we created our own traffic jam. We had cars lined up blocking one lane. We had fire trucks and APD behind the ambulance. There was literally no way for anybody to get out of there. APD and the fire truck had to back down the road 300 or 400 yards to the next turnout to where they could let the ambulance back past them, kind of thing. So, you know, it was a really minor event. There was no panic. There were no injuries, but we ended up with a fairly significant traffic jam. The delay of traffic was probably 45 minutes. It was not longer because with the permission of APD, some of the local residents simply hooked on to one of the damaged vehicles and pulled it out of the way, freeing up one lane of traffic that could get in and out. The issue of wildfire, specifically addressed in this bill, is well known to the residents here. Our overall structure up here in Bear Valley is quite primitive. All of our roads are gravel. They're actually in very poor condition. We don't have any fire hydrants or any other water access points, so if there is any sort of fire up here, be it a house fire or a wildfire, it's going to be very difficult to control. There are two main fire scenarios that the residents up here think about, and that is a fire that perhaps starts further down the hill towards town from us and then burns in an uphill fashion up into the valley. If that happens, that fire will encounter and close Clark's Road before it ever threatens any structures. It will be more than a mile away from my house, but Clark's Road would functionally be blocked off and closed. So there would be no way out. I'd be trapped. The other scenario is one that starts up higher in the valley or comes over the ridge and gets blown downslope by our fairly famous Bear Valley winds. We regularly clock 100 mile an hour winds up here. This scenario was brought to light some years ago when the McHugh Creek fire was burning right over the ridge, and they warned us that it may jump the ridge under those winds, in which case we would have this downslope fire wind pushed through our valley. In that case, the road's probably open, but you got everybody trying to get out at once, and you got all the emergency services trying to come up at the same time. So it might work, but it might not. One of the features that residents really appreciate about Bear Valley is our remote sort of wilderness feel. It's not super developed up here. Clark's Road passes through the Section 36 park that is not developed. It's very nice, but it also has a lot of old growth and brush along it. So it increases the risk of wildfire. In the spring of 2024, the local community councils, in conjunction with the Hillside Resilience Committee, initiated a plan to remove brush and trees along Clark's Road to reduce this wildfire risk. These guys had coordinated with the volunteer veterans group team Rubicon. They were on deck to do the work. However, it turns out there were some easement issues along there, and the whole project ended up being canceled. And none of it occurred. Representative Holland was heavily involved in this initial effort, and he did not give up simply because that first project got canceled. In 2025, he focused on the narrowest portion of Clark's Road down at the bottom, specifically on a clump of dead beetle-killed spruce that was actually overhanging the road. These things are obviously a significant fire hazard in their standing dead condition, but they're also going to come down at some point. They're dead trees. They're going to fall at some point, most likely during a wind event, in which case they would have fallen on and blocked our road. And so Representative Holland was able to work with the appropriate parties and get permission. This is a case where the trees were actually on Parks and Rec land, but within the state-maintained road right-of-way, and they were close to the Chugach electric power line. So there was a lot of coordination that had to happen. To avoid the power lines, the trees had to fall to the road. The state coordinated the traffic control, and he recruited local volunteers, myself included, to go down and cut and remove these trees. The work to cut the trees took us 3 or 4 hours. The work to get it all organized and all the permissions in place, I'm sure, took Representative Holland substantially longer than that. There's much more work along these lines that needs to be done along Clark's Road and up in Bear Valley. Representative Holland spearheaded this initial work, but there needs to be a broad-scale planning process to address this sort of issue. There's simply not time to pursue the work that Representative Holland did every time we need to clear a few trees that are in danger of impacting our road. However, that process is beyond what the residents are able to accomplish. We simply don't know the rules that have to be applied there, the process to follow, or the players involved. Meanwhile, the threats to our access and the number of people in our area continue to grow. So I guess my comment here is that I fully support the process that's described by this House Bill 317, and I think it's going to yield a positive outcome for myself and my neighbors up here in Bear Valley.
Thank you, Dr. Flint. And just for the record, Representative Holland joined us at 2:23 p.m., so he heard all your compliments. So thank you for that. Are there any questions for Dr. Flint? Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. Yes, so is the anticipation that the road would be cleaned up and tidied up, or is the anticipation to have another access road available?
Dr. Flint.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, ideally we would have another access road. The logistics of making that happen are, I think, unlikely in the near future. So our initial goal is simply to continue up along the lines of what Representative Holland started and continue to clear along Clark Road and increase the access that way.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Co-Chair. What's the population up in that area, approximately?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, I don't know for sure. Like I said, there's 485 parcels. I'm going to guess that over three quarters of them currently have residents on them. And, you know, how many people live in each residence? I don't know. If I had to guess, I'd say 1,000 people.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Dr. Flint? Seeing none, Dr. Flint, I'll just make a comment. I live in northeast Anchorage, North Muldoon, so I don't get down to Bear Valley too often. But I happen to had a appointment to look at a 2003 Jeep Wrangler there last November, and I was amazed at how remote a valley it was. I didn't realize we had something like that essentially in my backyard, and I really appreciated the remoteness, but I could see where access and fire danger is a real thing there. Did you have any comment on that?
Through the chair, co-chair, you've nailed it. Please keep our valley a little secret. We don't want the word to get out. It's the things that we really like about it up here, sort of the remoteness and the rural feel to it. But that's also what causes the risk that we're talking about today. So you can't have the good without a little bit of bad. So we're just trying to mitigate the bad the best we can.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. And then I just want to mention for the committee's awareness that we sent an email right before this committee meeting that one of Representative Holland's invited testifiers was unable to join us, Jennifer Schmidt from ICER. But Representative Holland's office requested if they could provide the information that she had provided. It's in a PowerPoint. And if there's no objection, I'd like to allow his staffer, Aiden Nickel, to briefly go through the slides, and I will enforce that. But I did say that without objection, so I do want to respect the committee's will. Representative Stutz.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. I have one more question.
For Dr. Flint?
For Dr. Flint, thank you. Do you have service districts over there?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, I guess service districts in terms of what? So we are on a limited road service area, a LRSA in our case, for our road maintenance. So we're locally controlled. Bill Ennis and I do all that. We have our own mill rate that applies taxes that we set essentially for ourselves. So we do all of our own road maintenance once you get to the end of Clark's Road, if that's what you're referring to.
Fire service.
Basically, so you have a road service area then? And
yes,
and are you correct. Telling me it doesn't encompass this road that you're talking about wanting cleaned up?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz. Yeah, so Clark's Road is the main paved access, and then once you leave the main paved road of Clark's, now you're in the limited road services area. So that's Bear Valley Road Service Areas after you leave the state paved road.
Thank you. Do we have a map of that area?
The question is, do we have a map of the area? I did try to call it up, but I got another state when I put down Clark's Road because I wanted to see where I'd been. But I do see Representative McCabe had a question.
So thanks. Dr. Flynn, do you have a fire service area up there? Is the city of Anchorage providing your fire service, or do you have volunteers?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe. Yeah, we're in the fire service area. We're supported by the Bear Valley Fire Station, which is right down at the bottom of the hill here. So we are in the Anchorage Fire Service Area.
Thanks.
Are there any further questions for Dr. Flint? And seeing none, if there are no objections to having Mr. Nickel briefly go through that, we'll take a brief at ease so he can bring those slides up on the monitor. At ease. back on the record to put the brief invited testimony from Dr. Jennifer Schmidt, who is not present. But Aiden, would you give us a brief overview of these slides?
Absolutely. For the record, Chair Eichheit, Aiden Nichols, Staff Representative Holland, there are just a couple slides in this presentation that I want to highlight because they address questions previously asked by the committee in the last hearing. So Co-Chair Eichheit, you and Representative St. Clair asked for a definition of WUI in the last hearing. You'll find that on page 2 of the presentation here. So Dr. Schmidt defines a wildland urban interface area as simply the area where houses meet or intermingle with undeveloped wildland vegetation. And you'll see examples in the presentation of a 0 to 100 scale that takes into account the wildfire hazards at a given point. The issue that Dr. Schmidt outlines here is that there are no specific objective statewide criteria for WUI. There are municipalities and boroughs that have adopted WUI standards, including Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Mat-Su. What we do have here in Alaska, Dr. Schmidt pointed out, is an annually updated fire management prioritization map created in collaboration between state and federal agencies. You'll find this map on page 4 of the presentation, and it describes how aggressively fire suppression will take place against a fire in a given region. So these yellow and red areas, designated critical and full response areas, indicate where a fire potentially would pose the greatest threat to human life. So the committee asked an excellent question that exposed an ambiguity in the bill. Some jurisdictions have defined WUI areas, some do not. So we're now actually considering a change to the bill's language around wildland urban interface zones, potentially adding the terms critical and full currently recognized by state agencies to broaden the bill's scope. So the bill would then direct action toward wildland urban interface areas or areas designated as critical or full under the wildland fire management options. And that is all I have. Thank you very much again for the time.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Nichol? Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Yes, I do. And I think you probably have the same question. Maybe. I'm looking at this, and I was looking at the fiscal note, the zero fiscal note. How can that be?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, there are two fiscal notes, and one is zero. And there is,
and I would just like to invite Representative Holland up to the dais if he'd like to join, or Mr. Andy Mills is also in from DOT is also in the room.
And Mr. Mills, I believe, would be better equipped to explain the DOT's fiscal note than I would.
Thank you. I only see one, so thank you for that.
I only have one, too.
And through the chair, my apologies if that was omitted in the packet. I will make sure that that is.
We're making copies.
Okay. So, fiscal note incoming, I guess. Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Nichol? Representative McCabe.
Well, I guess maybe I can wait for the fiscal note questions. Unless you want me to ask right now.
I'm sorry. I say again, Representative.
Said I can. Are we talking about the fiscal note now? I don't really have a question for Mr. Nichols, but I do have another question on the fiscal note. So,
I think I'd like to wait for. I think they're getting a copy of it.
Okay.
The most recent one. So,
okay. Remind
me to come back to you, Co-Chair Carey.
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. So, I'm struggling a little bit with this bill because maybe I'm struggling with the...
And just for... I'm sorry, Co-Chair Carrick, I apologize for interrupting. Just so you know, we do have public testimony notice for today, and we do have one person online. So I just want to... Maybe after the co-chair is done here, I'd like to go to the public testimony and maybe come back to respect our folks online.
Sounds good. Thank you for the reminder, Co-Chair Eichheit. So I'll just keep it brief. I guess I have just a little bit of concern with you know, one could say adding to, one could say further dividing the broad scope of what DOT does and adding this. And I might just be having trouble with the term wildland urban interface zones for a couple reasons. One is we have a lot of rural airports that are the only way in and out of a community. We were just talking about some of those. And if there's a wildfire in some of our communities, I'm thinking of Shugnak as a good example. There's trees all surrounding the community. The airport is the only way in and out of that community. I'm not sure they would qualify reading about this bill as part of what would be part of this plan development. And then a second, maybe just concern I have is in that presentation we just heard, we saw that there's not a uniform definition of wildland urban interface zone. And I know in Fairbanks we have a ton of road service areas, some of which are the only egress in and out of a particular neighborhood, and we're a high wildfire area. So it just brings forward a couple of different questions for me. This makes a lot of sense when you think about that specific invited testifiers example. I don't know how much it's copy and paste applicable to other situations in the state. So if you have comments on any of that, that'd be great. But I'm also happy to talk offline about some of those questions.
Mr. Nickel?
Through the co-chair, co-chair Carrick, I think these are excellent questions, and they definitely deserve a longer conversation. I will, a few things come to mind. This bill does address areas on the road system. It does not solely address areas in Anchorage. We examined a map of the road system, and there are residential areas across the state that would be impacted by this. Our belief is that it is important to facilitate wildfire safety and ease evacuations wherever that is necessary in the state. On the road system, it looks like this. Off the road system, there are other important measures that need to be taken. This is a piece of the puzzle, but by no means is it the complete puzzle. And my apologies if there were any elements of the question that I missed. Happy to talk offline.
Follow up.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair, because I know people have questions on the fiscal note. I am curious about the inclusion of a 12th, or a 17th, rather, kind of mission statement for DOT, as opposed to, I see a few of these, and I've never actually read DOT's full what the department shall do items, so this is great for me, but I wonder if some of this would fit neatly into particularly items 1, 2, 5, and 7. There's a few items here where I could absolutely see improvement for urban wildland or wildfire interface zones being included as opposed to a new subsection or a new item. And that's more of a comment, I suppose. I'm going to leave it at that, but if you do have comment, feel free to add.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Carrick, I might, if he is comfortable and if I may, pass this question along to Andy Mills. I believe you are much more qualified than I am to speak to the scope of the duties of the Department of Transportation.
Andy Mills, Legislative Liaison and Special Assistant at the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. To the co-chair, one, you're quickly getting full steam on a lot of different issues, so trust me, in a few years we'll be hiring you at DOT. But on an answer for this one, so there's a number of different elements. We did, when we talked to the sponsor about this bill, register a general cautionary note about adding or amending the DOT core powers. And that I know that the sponsor was talking the last committee hearing on this bill about intent language and what we had done in a previous effort. And so I think there's probably an active conversation about what the right vehicle is for something along these lines. However, as you get an opportunity to review the fiscal note, which was on basis and available there, but not in your packets, that does show you that for DOT, we read the legislation and have interpreted it as a planning effort, largely, that we would step through, as we detail there. And then the actual implementation piece of it would require us to come back to the legislature. And as your speaker, Dr. Flint, I think did a fairly good job describing, there's a significant effort to every single area, both in the variation of easements, the depth of right-of-way, what you are dealing with. So resourcing the actual implementation of clearing some of this is a very substantial effort. So again, the focus of this in front of us is the planned effort, the planning effort to identify these areas.
I'm going to leave it there.
Can we go to our public testimony and then come back after that's done?
You're the boss.
Okay. I always ask polite permission. Okay, so we're going to now open public testimony on House Bill 317, DOT Wildland Urban Interface Maintenance Plan. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 317? Seeing none, we will now go online. And I do see a Troy Weiss. Mr. Weiss, would you put yourself on the record, identify any affiliation in your location, and please provide your public testimony?
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for letting me. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay, great. My name is Troy Weiss. I live up in what's called Stuckingham Heights, or the Basher Community Council in Anchorage. I'm also presently the president of Wooly Cat, and what Wooly Cat stands for is Wooly and then Community Action Team, and we're composed of representatives of the Resilience Committee trying to get all the Wooly areas of Anchorage to participate together, and we've got contacts in most of them. There's Sand Lake, which is over by the airport, is the only one that presently we don't have a representative for. We meet monthly and meet with AFD and talk about priority of projects, what projects they have going on fire resilience. We're also working with them on how residents can provide more resilience on their own, clean up their houses, what offers AFD has coming for deploy sprinklers to use to help suppress fires or to make things less flammable. Anyway, in regard, I live up in Stuckingham Heights. It's the Basher, or the Campbell-Erstrup Road is our only way in, only way out. About 225 residents up here, or homes up here. I'm not sure exactly how many residents. And I totally agree that when you have one way in, one way out, we need to provide special provisions for those types of areas. The big benefit I see out of House Bill 317 may be just identifying who is actually responsible for these roads that have one way in and one way out. It's very confusing. So our road runs through a municipal park. It comes up and then becomes maintained by LARSA. And down at the very end of it, where it ties into Tudor, it's DOT property, or DOT maintained. So it's very confusing. So I think the bill would take big steps forward if we just identify what areas have a neighborhood that's at risk with one way in, one way out, and who's responsible for maintaining it, then let them have the development of their plan. But the important part, from what I've seen, and I think Kai experienced at the Clark's Road project, was identifying who's responsible and then getting all the right heads to say, okay, we would support doing that project, or we'd support taking out those trees or whatever. That's about all I have to say. I really appreciate your time, and if I consideration or your support for this House bill.
Thank you, sir, for your public testimony. I see no one further online for testimony, so I'm closing public testimony on House Bill 317 at 2:51 p.m. So let's go back to our discussion on the bill. Representative McCabe, did you want to ask your fiscal note question or other questions?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Eichheit, or Co-Chair Eichheit. So my question, I think Mr. Mills answered. This is a planning bill. I get that. It has a potential to cost millions of dollars in a fiscal note for clearing. I mean, if you look at that map right there, you can tell it's going to cost millions. And I'm not so sure that, you know, I mean, I guess Clark's Road, we asked that last time, it's a DOT road. Is that right?
Yeah.
But yes. The one that he was just talking about is not a DOT road. That's a muni road. And so where does the DOT's responsibility start and end, and where does the municipality's responsibility start? I mean, we've been talking about the fire danger on the hillside in Anchorage for decades, and nobody's done anything. Why hasn't Anchorage done anything? Just because it's a DOT road? I don't know. I'm frustrated with this whole thing. I mean, I like the idea of the bill, but there are many, many, many thousands of people that are in the same boat all over Alaska, not just in Bear Valley.
Yeah, Mr. Nickel or Mr. Mills, you looked like you were queued up to say something, but I wasn't sure.
Again, Andy Mills for the record. So I was going to make a comment somewhat similar to the jurisdictional determination along some of these routes. I don't think this actually resolves that. It just puts a designation in the area for us to try and get to a prioritization matrix, which I believe is what's being sought by the planning effort. It won't resolve the easement identification and some of the permitting and potential liability, all of these things that make this, unfortunately, fairly complicated to execute on. But I also, in here, wanted to be sure I underscored that the urban versus non-urban conversation was one that I think the team in this planning effort would, from a DOT perspective, we would look to use data sets that exist from DNR and DOT in a GIS environment mapping system and try to overlap that to identify these areas where there, again, it's only the one-way in and one-way out road. So this is a subset of the WUIs. Mm-hmm. But it, from this presentation, again, any property that has something undeveloped beyond it, that's a lot of properties to work through. In Juneau alone, that's what I'm familiar with. That's actually quite a bit of the properties in Juneau that are backed up against the Tongass. I think it's going to take some judgment calls, which is what we would be doing in the planning effort when we pursue this. But it's just to correct, it's not going to solve the jurisdictional differences between them. And I would actually maybe make one correction to what Representative McCabe said. Maybe it's not millions, but multi-millions because of the effort. I know that one particular section of the Old Glen Highway that we were looking to cut back to the entirety of the right-of-way, that alone was about $1 million for a subset of that particular road to cut down trees and to get things hauled away. So I conceivably, again, once we're able to identify what these areas are, you would then get the scope of a potential effort that you would prioritize. And it's very conceivable that would be quite a bit more than millions. It might be tens of millions.
And Mr. Nichols, did you want to respond at all to anything before I move to Co-Chair Carrick?
Co-Chair Eichheit, I believe Mr. Mills covered that quite thoroughly, but through the Chair, Representative McCabe, if there's any outstanding questions, I'm happy to elaborate.
Good, thanks. Okay.
Co-Chair Carrick and then Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, through the Co-Chair. So I guess I recognize what this bill is trying to accomplish. I recognize how important it is to do this work. You're rarely going to see me advocate for a task force, but I just wonder if a task force might actually be the more appropriate mechanism to create that plan of prioritization, because this bill is not accomplishing that work per se. It's adding a plan for prioritization in, but DOT doing that in a silo doesn't actually feel like it's going to necessarily solve some of the problems. so, I mean, I'm just more familiar with Fairbanks than with Anchorage, but so much of Fairbanks is confusing. There's DOT right in the middle of borough, right in the middle of road service areas. It's super confusing, and we're a high wildfire area challenge. So I'm a little concerned about, again, what some would call expanding, others might call fragmenting, but in either case, we're changing DOT's scope of work, but we might only be creating that prioritization plan from DOT's perspective, and I don't know if that's fully taking into account issues around the state and where those planning issues might actually lie. So DOT should be part of it, but I'm not quite sure if this is the approach. And I guess this is more of a question for the bill sponsor, but was there consideration of some other mechanism to accomplish this besides this mechanism? Maybe one that includes more of the multifaceted components of creating a plan?
Whoever wants to go to that, Representative Holland is approaching, so yes. Put yourself on the record and
take that as an invitation.
Answer that question, please, sir.
We finally got him.
Yeah, Kai Holland, House District 9 Representative. Thank you for the opportunity to share a little bit on this. As far as a brief answer to this question, we've done this, you know, over the last 8 years in a couple different types. This isn't the first bite at the apple on dealing with this issue. One of the reports that you'll have uploaded to BASIS that comes with this material from Dr. Schmidt is a report on the task force work that we did back about 6 years ago that was funded by the legislature, that provided money through then Senator Revac, that funded us to be able to look at this egress issue. And it was essentially a pilot study to say, how do we involve the community and community stakeholders to study these areas with limited access, to look at the right-of-ways, to look at the complexities of who's involved in the right-of-ways, and to develop a plan. And so that acts as kind of a starting point that we learned a lot from. And I would encourage you to read that report that's available to you now with these resources to see what we did do. Dr. Schmidt and a team also worked on this issue in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Whitehorse a couple years ago, and I was involved in that process. And we worked for a year and a half in each of those communities with all the stakeholders, looking at the long-term view of wildfire hazards in those communities and how they would address those. So those are two examples of what's gone on here in Alaska. And, of course, nationally, this has been a major issue. We only have to look at the loss of lives, loss of houses, to realize how important this issue has become when areas like Paradise with a campfire became trapped or became gridlocked and people were trapped in there. And we lost a lot of lives and lost, you know, over 18,000 buildings in that. So this is kind of going the next step. It's suggesting that we need some broader policy to help guide this process and to look at the area of the DOT roads that would then give us a broader framework.
I want to give Representative St. Clair a chance if I could. Go ahead.
Real quick, thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. The question I have is, can this same thing be done with intent language and a budget amendment? I mean, and I guess that's kind of would be for Andy and Rep Holland. I don't, this bill does nothing except says, let's talk about it. And from what you're saying, Rep Holland, we've been talking about this for a while.
If I can?
Yeah.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, I would suggest that right now the way the bill is framed is it does two things. One is it establishes policy by adding that, I believe, 17th item on there that says prioritizing DOT facilities for WUI resilience is now a policy of DOT. That to me is significant because that does not exist. And the second thing it does is then establishes a project to begin assessing how that policy would unfold in terms of assessing these areas. So, you know, doing the task force would be another way to study it, and that would be maybe a step forward. But there's two parts to this bill, and I don't want to lose track of the importance of both parts.
Okay, thank you. And Representative McCabe, we're wrapping up here.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. So to me, this is an Anchorage issue. This is not a DOT issue. You as urban, Anchorage is urban. It doesn't matter who owns the road. It's an urban issue. Fairbanks, Whitehorse, these are urban issues. The wildland, if it does come to wildland, then it would be DNR. I don't think that tasking the DOT just because the road happens to go through there, unless part of the task force or somebody says we need another road, that's a different story. That's a construction issue. To me, this is an Anchorage issue, and if we land on a task force of some sort, the city needs to be on the task force. This is an Anchorage issue. That's the urban part of it.
And just Representative McCabe, you don't think this would apply to the Mat-Su and in some of those areas, you know, Palmer Fishhook, you know, but you have a better knowledge of the Mat-Su.
Yeah, so that would be a borough issue. I mean, that, you know, that's the Mat-Su borough, and they have the overarching control of the issue, the urban part of it, or Wasilla, city of Wasilla issue, or city of Palmer issue. That's the U part of it, right? Mm-hmm. The wildland part, if there is wildland, maybe it's the borough if they own the land surrounding it, maybe it's DNR. You know, I'm not real sure, you know, in the, like, Bear Valley where the city of Anchorage ends, I think it goes all the way to the People's Republic of Girdwood. But
Girdwood?
Girdwood, sorry. But, I mean, seriously, I think, you know, this should be an Anchorage issue. That's the urban part of it. You know, just because the DOT has a road there, you know, if we need wildland help, then we need DNR help. Or forestry, or somebody like that, unless it comes down to the DOT. The DOT builds roads. They're for transportation for the most part. I'm not sure if we would have to change it to DOT and PF and WF, wildland firefighting, or, you know.
Wooey.
Yeah.
Well, I want to give Representative Holland the last crack at this. We are past our time, so if you want to make any brief final comments.
You know, I think this has been a good discussion. I appreciate the time today, and I hope you will look both at the full report that Dr. Schmidt provided in his PowerPoint and the report in there. I think it provides a lot of context for this. And, you know, I do view this as a statewide issue that certainly I've learned about by virtue of working in Anchorage, but it's an important area. You know, I got involved in this project back a few months after the Paradise Campfire in California, and I realized that across Alaska we face the same risk of what happened in Paradise. And I've been working since then to learn about policies and actions that would make sure that we didn't become the next Paradise, the next Lahaina, the next Palisades, the next Bend, the next Fort McMurray, the next Boulder. You know, city after city after city have not addressed this issue, and their residents and their community has suffered for it. And I think we can take a positive step forward. We will have spent $100 million this last year in doing wildfire fighting. And if you're going to be concerned about spending a couple $1 million to try and reduce the risk to our community, then, you know, I think that's a good investment.
Well, thank you, Representative Holland. Thank you, Mr. Nickel, your staffer, Aiden Nickel, for appearing before us today. That brings us to the end of our agenda today. Our next House Transportation Committee meeting will be next week, Tuesday, April 14th at 1 o'clock p.m. This meeting is adjourned at 3:03 p.m.